Well, we're delighted to welcome back Amy Heron onto the show from the Irish Writers' Centre. Amy, how are you?
Hey, Morgan. How's it going? Good, thanks. Nice to hear a bit of Bowie as well.
It's my first time back into the studio since the great man passed, so I mean, I couldn't pass up the opportunity really to play one of the songs anyway, so delighted I could do it. But Amy, how are you? How are you getting on? Irish Writers' Centre, new year?
Yeah, new year, and off to a busy start, to be honest, as per usual, really, I guess. We kicked off our first week back with a sold-out Nollaig na Mban event, which was really, really fantastic in terms of the lineup, the whole atmosphere of the event and everything. We had a really great range of female writers, the likes of Sinéad Gleeson, Joanna Walsh, Mary O'Donnell. So they got riled up at the start of the new year and took to our soapbox, and it was really, really great fun. And then following that,
was there anything in particular being promoted, or was it just trying to get people to read more women?
Well, we were actually celebrating Nollaig na Mban, so obviously it's a tradition that isn't really celebrated in Dublin, and we're trying to put kind of a contemporary spin on a tradition that sort of stems from the Southwest. And I suppose for us it was the second consecutive year running it, and we're just interested in programming an all-female lineup for the night that's in it. However, we welcome all genders to attend and join in the spirit and atmosphere of the night. I mean, judging from the last 2 years, I think we'd be mad not to make a hat trick of it. So save the date for the 6th of January next year. Yeah,
you also had another pretty esteemed visitor popping into the centre during January.
So Nollaig na Mban was followed up very swiftly by a very high-profile visitor, being Michael D. Higgins, our president. So that took place last Wednesday, and I guess it was really to mark the fact that we're 25 years this year, which is a nice feather in our cap. And then also, so it's we're off to a nice start to the year with all of these celebrations. And I guess the president was there as well, in that he has agreed to become the patron of the centre. So really, it's a nice sort of stamp of approval in terms of what we do and what we're about. So yeah, so suffice to say, after 2 weeks back, we're already wrecked.
Wonderful. And what was the night like? Did it go off without a hitch? How was Michael D?
He was in flying form, and his speech is actually available on our website, so you can kind of catch up. And interestingly, there might be a few sentences sort of omitted, that weren't on the official speech, but he gave a nod to the great man himself, Bowie, and we ended up going from Bowie to Descartes within a couple of sentences. So such is the talent of his, writing capabilities and speech abilities. So it was fantastic. We had a host of distinguished guests as well. Jennifer Johnson was here, then some, journalists, the likes of John Kelly, and so it was a full house. So
brilliant.
And I mean, yeah, we had a fantastic time. So
brilliant. But
onwards and upwards.
Yeah, it's back to the grindstone now. Though I was just checking out some of your evening season is beginning now. Thomas Morris, I actually picked up his book there last week. Got it as a present.
Yeah, it's a fantastic read. So Tom is joining us with the Irish Times Book Club. So the Irish Times pick a featured author every month, and although their book club usually takes place on a digital basis, we invite them to come into the centre every month, and we record the podcast live here. So Tom will be chatting to the Irish Times team, perhaps about his inspirations. He's Welsh himself, yet seems to have a grawl for our country. So no doubt we'll be picking that apart, and it's a fabulous collection of short stories, so
really
highly recommended.
And you've also got stuff going on during Tradfest, Duke special coming on in.
Yeah, now tickets for that are actually all sold out.
Duke
Special is joining us for I mean, they sold out very quickly, as you can imagine. It's kind of it's a subsidised workshop with Duke Special, so at a highly enviable rate of €10. So anyone who is lucky enough to get in there fast is probably delighted with themselves. So it's our first time working with Tradfest, and it's a fantastic festival that just seems to be growing year upon year. And the great thing is that an awful lot of their events are free therefore, like I say, kind of, you know, subsidised and therefore quite cheap. So, yeah, it's actually our first songwriting workshop here officially. So while we might have musicians in to talk about their own writing, this is the first time that we've ever had them, you know, basically tackle the craft and communicate their own inspiration. So, yeah, that should be a really interesting one.
Then
from there on... Yeah, absolutely. And then from there on in, we're into course season. So it's really been a hectic month, but we're getting used to being busy again.
I was thinking about some of the courses because I'm sure it's the season for New Year's resolutions, really, and a lot of people are kind of probably looking at that manuscript on their desk or that one that's still in their head or something, and they might have a check on the Irish Writers Centre's website just to see if there's any courses that might suit them.
We're on irishwriterscentre.ie, and there is a huge range, like you were saying, if someone has a novel. We also have courses for short story writers, memoir, essays, screenwriters, comedy, sci-fi. The list really could go on for quite a while.
Yeah.
So there's something, there really is something for every category of writer, and then also every level of writer too, you know, in terms of if you're just starting out or maybe you've hit, you know, a couple of speed bumps along the way somewhere. So what we're, I suppose, the new year, as you say, is the ideal time to, you know, get that bucket list and try and tick things off of it. And I suppose getting into good habits at the start of the year, you know, getting into a nice writing routine, and the light is kind of conducive to helping you along the way, you know, in the sense that they're dark mornings, you know, they're perfect for hibernating and, just getting stuck into the laptop.
Yeah, and there's some great names. Again, you've got Mancon McGann, of course, travel writer extraordinaire. I saw a couple of others. I know Conor Costick, he would have been a guy that I was a huge fan of. And Alan McGonigal, Ness O'Mahony, some brilliant names as always.
Yeah, Michelle Reed is back. We actually have, for the first time, another first for us is a graphic novel course with Declan Shelby, which probably broke our sales record in the sense that it sold out within something like 36 hours of going online, which shows you, just shows you that there is the demand for, how to create a comic or a graphic novel. You know, I guess it's not the kind of typical course that we would run, but there certainly seems to be an appetite for it. That's fantastic.
No, that takes me by surprise. Yeah, I wouldn't have thought that there would have been such a large market for it, but there you go.
Yeah, exactly. And I mean, we have a huge waiting list for it already, believe it or not. So, I don't want to say it'll definitely be on next term, but certainly watch this space. You know, it's if the demand is there, we'll obviously try and supply it, you know.
Definitely. And one of the most important dates in the Irish Writers Centre's year, I suppose, it's the open day. It's coming up soon as well, isn't it?
Yeah, so we have an open day on the 30th of January, so that's Saturday week, and we're just asking people, you know, who might be curious about us and what we do and what goes on in the centre.
It looks as if we've lost...
Coffee Roasters.
We lost you there for a second.
I was just explaining about our open day,
we're inviting
people to come along... Sorry, am I back?
Yeah, you're back. You're back now. Thought we'd lost you.
At risk of repeating myself, but we just want people to come by and have a coffee with us and maybe learn about what we do and, you know, what kind of supports are available to writers, whether it's, you know, workshops or seminars or perhaps some professional development. We'll be open from 10:30 on Saturday 30th and hoping to meet new writers, really.
And I can't emphasise enough how fabulous a resource the centre is, right in the centre of the city, just off Parnell Square, and I mean it's the perfect place to go if you're, as you say, whatever level you're at in terms of your writing career.
Yeah, well, actually, to quote President Higgins, now that I can, he described our place as a vortex of creativity, which I think is a really nice way of putting it. You know, I suppose we've kind of described it before as a haven, but I think vortex is probably a little bit more descriptive in terms of the kinds of things that go on here. Yeah.
Well, Amy, just remind us again in terms of how people can get in contact, how they can find out more information.
Sure, yeah. So our website is irishwriterscentre.ie, and, you know, all of our courses and events are listed there, as well as writing opportunities and competitions and the like. And then we are very active on social media, so it would be lovely to connect with new people via Facebook and Twitter. We are newbies when it comes to Instagram, but we will get there. So be patient with us. But yeah, give us an old follow over there as well. We'll be happy to start developing that side of our social media too.
Brilliant stuff, Amy. Great to talk to you, and I'm very happy. Can we still say that? A happy new year, actually. Is it too late?
I used to live in France, and you get to say it until the very end of January over there, so I still continue that tradition here. Yeah, so we're absolutely happy new year.
You too, Amy. All the best.
Thanks a million, Morgan.
Bye-bye.
Cheers,
bye-bye. Bye-bye. That was, of course, Amy Heron, events coordinator from the Irish Writers' Centre. And, they're back to the grindstone, back working hard. And really do stop in if you have any interest at all. Really, really fabulous resource right in the centre of the city, just off Parnell Square. Another piece of music now, and we're going to keep it up in the David Bowie vein. This one is off one of his, relatively early albums. It's Diamond Dogs, and it is the rock classic Rebel Rebel.
Writer's Block on 90.3 Near FM with me, Morgan O'Reilly, the best local literary radio.
And you're very welcome back to Writer's Block, folks, with me, Morgan O'Reilly, right here on 90.3 Near FM. Well, it's after 4 o'clock, which means, of course, we have a living, breathing writer that has come into the studio, and I'm very pleased to welcome Sean O'Halloran.
Hello.
Sean, we'll get the boring stuff out of the way first. Where are you from? Just introduce yourself generally to our listeners, please.
Right. So the first thing that probably will be very apparent is my American accent. It's not as pronounced as you would find across the Atlantic. It is something that I get a lot. I've lived in Dublin 24 years now, like as long as I can remember, but it's something you don't really lose, that little American twang. But I've lived here all my life. I studied in Maynooth. I got my postgrad in UCD, and I work in a company called Grant Thornton as a forensic investigator.
Excellent. We will return to your American heritage, I'm sure, later on in the conversation.
Indeed.
But we are here, of course, to talk about your writing. Has it always been something for you? Is it something you've come to recently?
As long as I can remember, like I remember being like 4 or 5 years old, and I would dictate to my mother, who would be on like the word processor writing up like all the weird ideas that I had. I wish I kept more of those stories, because they're quite funny, but it's something that I've always, it's always been a very big part of my life, kind of writing. And I remember I used to do it in primary school, and it was always sort of my ambition to be a well-known writer from a very young age.
Of course, and from the pieces that I've got from you, I've got a couple of prose pieces, short story and a novella. But what form are you drawn to most? Well, we'll come back to the novella, because it's quite a peculiar form, I suppose, in itself. Mm. But are you mainly a prose writer? Do you dabble in anything else?
Yeah, I kind of, prose would be my main sort of approach. Like I find there's always been this kind of schism in among writers, whether you're kind of more poetic in your approach to things, or you have more of a prose approach. And as much as I don't really agree with that, I find that a lot of writers use a combination of the two. I would find in my own writing that I tend more towards the kind of the more storytelling prose approach, as opposed to the love of language that comes with the more poetic approach. Like I said, it's something that I wish I had more of a kind of poetic ability. So I do want to sort of, explore that side of things.
Can you elaborate on that? I find that quite an interesting concept. So depending on what form a writer chooses, that gives you some kind of great insight into their aesthetic as a whole, or not even their, even even greater than their aesthetic, the kind of person that they are.
Well, I think it even comes down to sort of what you're practicing, kind of like what muscles you're exercising. So as a poet, you're looking at language and kind of the ear of your sentence structure and meter, and it's really about sounding good and being very evocative in your imagery. And a storyteller, like a prose writer, is a lot more focused about on, you know, character development and story arcs, and kind of making sure that everything sort of comes together in a satisfying way. And it's a lot more mm-hmm. focused on kind of story mechanics. And I feel like a marriage of the two is what makes great writing, like Shakespeare and writing of that level. But there tends to be an approach where there's a literary kind of approach that's very kind of poetic and very language focused. And then there's also a more sort of kind of screenwriter, cut and dry, you know, get to page 13 and make sure your character has an inciting incident by then sort of approach. I don't think being an extremist in any direction is a great way to go about it. But, you know, there is, I think most people fall on one side or the other as far as where their kind of focus lies.
Great, very interesting. We'll move back to you yourself as a writer. You're a young man, you've got a pretty busy job, I imagine. How do you fit it in? Do you write in groups? Are you a lone wolf? Do you do workshops? I mean, what works for you in terms of the writing process?
That is one of the fundamental kind of things for me, is just finding the time to write and being in the right sort of headspace. Because a big kind of part of, you know, for me, I always need a certain level of inspiration. I can't just sit down. And it's something that I hate about myself, is that I sort of lack the discipline. You know, Stephen King says you need to do about 1,000 to 2,000 words a day to sort of properly get your story out there. And it's something that I've never, maybe a week for me at best. So it's something that I kind of, you know, I'm trying to work on. And I have been to a few workshops and writing groups. And I think it's really beneficial to sort of subject yourself to criticism. You know, you don't really improve unless you're kind of getting feedback from people and kind of exploring your weaknesses as a writer. Like, it's very easy to sort of focus on, like, and it sort of comes back to the poetic versus prose thing. It's very easy to go, oh, I write, you know, great language very well, or like, you know, my characters are very compelling, and just try and build a whole story around that. But sort of talking to other writers and seeing how their approach, like, they'll be very strong in an area you're very weak at, and you sort of learn from them, and they can kind of tell you how they do their thing, and you can tell them how, and you have a very sort of collaborative thing that everyone benefits from. And I think that's very beneficial.
Speaking about weaknesses, I'm not sure if this is a weakness, but a contentious issue possibly, or worthy of discussion at least. You're a young man. What do you think of the tag of young writer? I mean, and there's a lot of kind of expectations of a young writer. I'm thinking of, you know, breaking rules and dealing with the now as opposed to the past and
yeah.
so on.
Yeah, like, as far as an expectation for young writers to write in a particular way, I think that, you know, that's not very reasonable. But I do think young writers, like all young people, are really trying to find their role in society and sort of find how they fit in with everything. So kind of the art that they produce will always have an element of sort of exploring society and its limits, and kind of trying to sort of explore themselves and how people fit into society. And I think so, in kind of almost as a byproduct of being a sort of a younger writer, your writing will tend towards a certain kind of niche, which would be more kind of exploratory, more kind of anti-authoritarian, sort of looking for alternatives to the norm and that sort of thing. But I don't think anyone should try to, like, constrain themselves towards a particular approach or anything.
You were talking there about all young people, in a sense, are trying to find themselves, their place, I should say, in society. Is writing self-exploratory for you? Is it a working out of something?
Yeah, well, in many ways, yes. Like, I don't feel that sort of, like some people use writing as a kind of therapy, and I always feel like it's much more of a, like you can write something in your bedroom, and you know, if you're happy with that, that's great. But if you want to sell writing or kind of have other people experience it in the way that you want, you have to take more of a critical kind of, it can't just be like a form of therapy. It can't just be you on your own exploring yourself. You kind of have to present it in a way that people can understand and accept. And really, it's about making other people reflect on themselves. In the same way, you're trying to evoke in them your own sort of thoughts about yourself and your own. So as you're trying to explore your place in society, you're also trying to question, like pose questions to people and ask them, well, where do you fit into society, and is it working for you, and you know, get them to reflect on what they're trying to achieve in life and that sort of thing. And I think that's what a lot of good art makes you do, is kind of think about your own life and your own experiences.
Okay, we'll get on to, I suppose, you know, your writing doesn't stay in your bedroom all the time. It has to get out there and get read. So what has your experience been like with publishing or competitions with being read?
So it's something that I've only just kind of begun to do, is to start submitting to competitions and to publications. And it's mainly because I've never really been in a position where I felt all that confident doing so. It's taken, you know, 20 years of writing before I really felt like it was something worth sharing with people. And maybe that's just my own insecurities, but in a lot of ways, I think you do need to start kind of engaging with the writing community and talking to people who are in a position, like a kind of a mentoring position, who can sort of tell you, like, this is what works and this is what doesn't. And so you're sort of reinforced in your own approach. So you don't need to kind of just sort of make it up as you go along. You can kind of have a guiding hand that will say, like, you know, if you want to get published, you know, this is not necessarily what you have to do, but like, here's some ideas to think about, to consider when you're off on your own in your bedroom writing. You can kind of have this in the back of your mind. And I think that's an important part of, you know, the whole publication process, is keeping in mind your audience and keeping in mind who's going to be reading it and what they're going to be thinking of it. Cool. As much as controversial as that may be, I know there's plenty of writers who are like, you know, you just write what's in your heart and, you know, damn them if they don't appreciate it. But I would sort of be in the kind of, you have to be more kind of diplomatic about it. Like, it's sort of it's a two-way process. It's not just you giving a speech. You're kind of, like I said before, trying to evoke a feeling in someone, so it has to be more of a dialogue.
A very diplomatic answer. Let's move on to your actual writing, the two pieces I've read, to be precise. And I'd like to talk about them in terms of thematically. Both offer their very firm kind of historical settings, one in the very near future, or the present, I suppose, and then the other takes us all the way back to the famine times. How much is historical fiction a thing for you? Is it something that you like to return to or that you explore?
Kind of a big part of historical fiction is drawing from the setting of the story. So your kind of objective is always to evoke a kind of a transportative feeling, where you're trying to bring your readers into another time period, even if it's just like a certain kind of like a part of Dublin, like contemporary Dublin. You're trying to sort of bring them into this space, and to do that it requires a lot of work, just to, you know, do all the research and get all the things right, and you make so many mistakes and people will point them out to you and go, oh god, you know, people don't talk like that. And you know, it's part of the kind of the rewriting process that you hammer all this stuff out. But you know, I think it's very rewarding to have the setting be so much part of the story. So you've got all these extra elements you can bring in to sort of inform the way the story is progressing. It gives it a whole very nice sort of rich, holistic kind of feeling to it.
It's a setting, I suppose, specifically for your novella, The Coffin Ship. I mean, it strikes me as well. I mean, when we're, you know, the title is The Coffin Ship, and many Irish people will know what a coffin ship entails, really. It was one of the ships that sailed to America during the famine, and it was called a coffin ship because so many people perished during the voyage. But also, it has a deeper meaning. And we were briefly just chatting off air, and we were talking about, you know, titling stories, and you were saying that you often have a difficulty titling stories. Tell me about some of the considerations that you had when you were thinking of The Coffin Ship.
Yeah, like, I think it's a common complaint for a lot of writers that, you know, it's really hard to name things. Like, you know, a lot of the time people will be naming their kid, and it's a decision that they go through, you know, for months. And I find it's kind of similar as a writer. You have this thing that you've kind of been worrying about for years, and you finally kind of given birth to it, and you have to come up with a name, and it is very sort of difficult. And the one I picked for my story about coffin ships was The Coffin Ship.
It's very evocative, obviously, for Irish people.
Well, yeah, and I picked it because, on the one hand, like, you know, an Irish person would immediately know what it's about, but also I just love the sort of the description of these ships as coffin ships, because there's something very kind of poetic, like the way it distills in two words down the whole crux. Like, I had a few American friends come to me and even from the name alone, Coffin Ship, they were able to tell what it was about. Like, they knew it was going to be a dark sort of horror where people die, and it's going to center around death, and obviously a sea voyage. So even without knowing the kind of backstory to it, they still were able to understand the essential elements of the story. So that's what sort of spoke to me about the title.
Before we came on air, you were asking me questions about censorship, you know, and when people are talking about censorship, they're always talking about violence and sex, of course, and you were kind of asking me, what can I say, what can I not say? Of course, with reference to your own material, because both stories, the novella and your short story, The Fisher, are quite violent. They do feature scenes of often extreme violence. I mean, censorship, self-censorship, in terms of what you want and what you don't want to write, but also censorship with a view to the market, I suppose, are very important considerations for any writer. But back to this issue of violence, tell me about violence in your work as tools of narrative progression and as tools of characterization.
Violence, I've always found, kind of resonates with people on a very deep level. Like, no matter what culture you come from or what your background is, you understand it on a kind of a visceral level, and it's that aspect of violence that I find very useful as a tool, like as a kind of a tool in your writer's tool belt. But also, like a lot of the best kind of writing, it doesn't just use it for shock value or for gratuitous reasons. It is more of a mechanism to explore how kind of social structure breaks down when you introduce violence. So the relationships between people almost degenerate to an animalistic level, where it's about defending yourself or someone you care about, or it's about asserting your dominance in a very kind of, like, you know, animal kingdom sort of way. And it's that thing that I think fascinates a lot of people. It's a reason why it's sort of an escapist kind of mechanism. It's like, what would it be like to live in a world where, like, I can just go and kill my boss if he, you know, makes me feel bad? And there's a lot of stories that come out of that.
Was there any reaction when you showed either the novella or the short story to, you know, possible publishers or competitions?
Yeah, like, I've been surprised by how many people respond very positively to the extreme violence and some of the kind of sexual themes in my works. Like, I tend not to censor myself until I'm kind of asked to. I write with the approach of, like, I'll put it in, and if there's a huge backlash against it, I'll rethink it. But the kind of the response I got from some people was that it's almost not enough. Like, they want more. I found that quite funny, because, like, you know, you write something and when you're alone writing, it's sort of in a vacuum, so you never know how people are going to react. Or they think I'm some sort of weirdo or something. But, you know, people, like I said, they really resonate with these themes, and it's a kind of a dark undertone. It gives it a grittiness that people find compelling, and you can really sort of use this. Like in my book, I explore the idea of people wanting violence, and so when it's provided, I almost kind of bring the reader into it and question, well, like, what is it about violence that you find so compelling, and like sort of invite them to reflect on that, because so much of our media these days, you can't watch a film or a TV show without there being like blood and guts. Like even on, like, you know, Saturday morning CSI shows that my mom watches, it's horrifying, you know, the rape and the murders and everything is just kind of standard fare these days.
And it's funny, you mentioned, I mean, one of the words you used when you're talking about the ship itself in The Coffin Ship, your novella, was you said it was something like an animal kingdom. And there is that sense that there's this kind of, it's the law of the gun, it's, you know, every man for himself. But The Coffin Ship is, you know, mid-19th century. So to the reader, I mean, you can kind of hide behind this pretense that, you know, we were a little more uncivil or a little more uncouth. But if we translate that into your short story, The Fisher, I mean, we're talking about present day Ireland, England. Well, it could be any Western society, really. Mm. And, you know, there's no hiding the violence in that story. And there's far more than physical violence in The Fisher as well.
Yeah.
So talk to me about the psychological violence in The Fisher.
Yeah, it's a different kind of violence that people don't really talk about that much, is the kind of the manipulation and the way men primarily, but also women, can sort of use psychological warfare to sort of get what they want from people and sort of put other people in a weaker position just through, you know, manipulating and using underhanded kind of techniques. So violence doesn't necessarily have to be blood and guts and that sort of thing.
It is a very modern tale. It's thoroughly hooked into the digital age, I suppose.
That probably comes from my own sort of links to technology, and like in my professional capacity, I'm a forensic investigator who works a lot with kind of computers and mobile phones. That's where we get a lot of digital evidence, and it's incredible to see how much of a insight that can give into somebody's life. It's like your mobile phone these days is the window to your soul, as melodramatic as that sounds.
I was just when you say that, it strikes me. I think I was out on the 29th of December, we're out having a couple of drinks, and we all wrote down our New Year's resolutions on our phones.
And that stuff doesn't go away. Even if you delete it, sometimes it can be recovered. And you know, as part of my job, I get these cases where you see somebody's entire life kind of laid out in front of you. And it's fascinating that we live in an age where people's hopes and dreams and desires and fears are all in this little device they keep in their pocket. And so that kind of feeds into my writing and how people live their lives through technology, and it becomes so much an integral part of themselves.
In many ways, it's quite a surreal and quite a frightening story as well. But I mean, and it's consciously a frightening story.
Yeah, I have always sort of enjoyed surreality and magic realism, and you know, I'm inspired. The story was inspired by like a couple things. Like Twin Peaks was a big inspiration. I watched that fairly recently.
Of course, David Lynch's series.
Yeah, and it's I love all the like dreamlike sort of nightmarish qualities that it has, and I try to bring that in a bit, because there's something really sort of like everyone has these strange kind of dreams and even strange ideas that pop into their head, and just exploring the idea of, you know, influencing people's kind of subconscious is fascinating to me, and kind of how reality can break down and memories, you know, fade, and, you know, sometimes you can replace your own memories with fabrications, and it really makes you sort of question what is real, because all of our experiences are just kind of electronic signals, ultimately, to kind of paraphrase The Matrix. and, you know, that is part of how it can all break down, and I love sort of deconstructing major concepts, you know, society and reality and that sort of thing.
We already touched on, you know, the way you do enjoy writing historical fiction. I mean, both with The Famine Ship and While the Fisher is a very modern story, it's a very present story. It's definitely situated in the present moment and our digital age. Do you see yourself continuing to write in this vein?
Yeah, like in some ways, The Coffin Ship was kind of a break from what I do a lot, which is sci-fi. Like the influences of technology are pretty strong with me. And what I'm actually working on right now is kind of it's about hackers and digital investigators, and kind of ties more in with what I do professionally. It's, you know, a glamorized version of it. But I have a novel I'm writing, and then I have kind of a computer game that I have as a companion piece. And the idea behind it is that actually kind of we'll take somebody who's decent with computers and sort of teach them to hack a bit into like computer networks. Now it's sort of fantasy hacking, but it has a narrative to it that I'm working on, which like you'll find people's emails and you'll have chats with people online. They're all fictional people, but I really love exploring sort of different mediums. Like it's not necessarily just the typical things you can imagine. You really, in this day and age, have to think outside the box. And I've heard of all sorts of interesting approaches, like people doing flash fiction on Twitter, and you know, a lot of different approaches. People have blogs where they'll put stories up and they link to each other. It's called hypertext fiction. And so it'll be like, you know, you click on a word and they'll bring you to another chapter, and then you start reading that and you click on another word, and it's very kind of you know, it's like going down a rabbit hole. And the thing I'm working on is kind of similar, where it's you can take a story and you can make it have an exploratory element, so people get out of it what they want. If you want to just go through the story quickly, you can just follow the main thread. But if you find a character that you like, you can, you know, look into their backstory. You might find an email, and you don't have to read the email, but if you want to know more about the character, you can. And you can then, you know, look at the email chain and learn more about them. And it's something you can't really do in a book or a movie or a poem or pretty much most forms of traditional media. You're shown what the creator intended, and that's it. You don't really have that same kind of level of interactivity, which I think kind of in this day and age, like you don't have to be. A lot of people think of computer games and they think, oh, like, you know, I don't have the manual dexterity to kind of jump over the boxes and escape the monkey throwing barrels at you, you know, that sort of thing. But it's kind of as a medium, it's sort of matured and evolved into something where you can, like my game, you are just typing and you can do it at your own pace. You could take 20 minutes to work out the next puzzle or read the text coming on your screen. Like, it doesn't necessarily have to be an intense experience. It can be kind of a leisurely sort of almost like how people will read on their smartphones or Kindles or that sort of thing.
And Will, are you kind of pioneering in this ground, or is how much of this exists already? I've heard myself of, you know, poets who only publish their things on Twitter, and you know, they've got millions and millions of followers. And
yeah, like it's definitely like you might be appealing to a different demographic, but you know, it's as strong now as ever. You know, the internet isn't going away, and you know, video games and interactive media are going to be here for a very long time. They're coming out with virtual reality now, which actually sort of transports you so you can look around the world, and it's getting very sort of technologically incredible. It's going to be like Star Trek in a few years.
And do you think it takes away from the traditional, you know, reader?
I don't think so. You can get kind of pretentious about the feel of the pages and the smell of a new book, and I myself, you know, I love books, and I don't think that's ever going to go away either. But taking a sort of reasonable approach, like you know, I don't feel like there's any reason to kind of avoid this stuff. Yeah. Like you know, it is a matter of personal taste, but there's nothing inaccessible about it. There's nothing that you couldn't, like, you know, it's not for kids, you know, it's something that you can enjoy, you know, no matter who you are.
Yeah, I mean, I've had plenty of poets. I mean, what you're saying now, it's I mean, I've heard this before. I've had plenty of poets on the show who they're into all these kind of new innovative forms of poetry, slam poetry. Mm. I've had guys on the show who said that, you know, the poetry book is dying. It's all going to be video now. It's going to be poetry videos. And, you know, you've got a guy on YouTube and he just uploads a volume of poetry through videos and stuff.
Yeah, and the way sort of modern society is approaching this is like, you know, all the money will be in online videos and that sort of thing. Like that's like a kind of with your YouTube and Google and all of these companies really emphasizing online video content and streaming and that sort of thing. There's a sort of a shift away from traditional publishing, and it's something I think we should all embrace. Like I don't think fighting against it is going to be very beneficial to anyone, you know. As both like a producer, like as a writer, you're producing content, and to sort of limit yourself to one particular avenue, I think is kind of sort of silly. Like, you know, you've got all these different approaches you can take, and in many ways it's kind of liberating, because, you know, if Random House or Penguin or someone rejects you, you know, you could go onto a website. I've heard of a woman who's made millions on her, like, essentially a fan fiction of Twilight that she sort of converted into a book series, and it did really, really well, and she's made lots of money.
And they've made movies about that.
Well, it depends who you're talking about, but yeah, like the self-publishing market is huge. Like, people like what they like, and, you know, you can't you gotta sort of roll with that.
But I suppose you have to, I'm playing the devil's advocate here, you have to allow for people that are going to be resistant to change. Even in your short story itself, The Fissure, there's a huge element of danger in these technological advances.
Yeah, I mean, that really is the sort of the double-edged sword of technology, is that I'm saying that as someone who is a security consultant, the more you kind of embrace technology in your life, the more kind of risk you add in. But there's always, you know, there's always a nice middle ground. You know, if you put too much of yourself out there online, obviously you're going to attract unwanted attention. But if you're careful about how you live your online life, you can, there's a tremendous amount to benefit from sort of embracing technology in art and in general.
Well, I agree. And if Arnold Schwarzenegger has taught us anything, it's that machines can't be trusted. Right. Well, the time is almost 4:30. Sean, it's been great to have you in.
Absolutely. It's been great talking to you, Morgan.
Yeah, a real pleasure. A really interesting, stimulating chat. We will look out for your work in bookshelves around the country. I'm sure you'll get your break soon. Very talented writer.
Thank you.
Really, really enjoyed reading your stuff. Thanks again to all our listeners, of course, as well. You've been listening to Writer's Block on 90.3 Near FM with me, Morgan O'Reilly. If you'd like to contact the show, you can, of course, always email me, morgan_O'Reilly@live.com. And if you'd like to go on Twitter, you'll get all the events, the information, the podcasts, and news and information, about all of our contributors and guests. The Twitter handle is @Morgan_O'Reilly. That's @Morgan_O'Reilly. That's it for today. Thanks very much for listening. I'll be back in 2 weeks' time. Do join us then. Bye-bye.